The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada and is supported by the generous donations of our listeners. If you would like to partner with us in this ministry, please go to apologeticscanada.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim.
Andy Steiger.
Terry Crosby.
All right. Do you have something for us today, Terry?
There's many religions in the world.
True.
Have you heard of Dudism?
No, but I want to. I may be a part of that religion.
Yeah, this guy created it after the movie The Big Lewinsky. So there's a guy that kind of goes through life. He doesn't really know what he's doing, and everything's dude, I guess, right? So he created this new religion, and there is close to probably 500,000 followers already.
Wow.
Of dudism.
Of dudes. Yep. Dudisms.
Dudisms. If you're a follower of dudism, you're a dude.
Yeah. They call it the Church of the Latter-day Dude.
Well, how does a dude practice dudism?
Okay. Well, let me give you their, you know, their lowdown. From what is dudism trying to liberate us? And the answer is thinking that's too uptight. To what state of being is dudism trying to bring us? Just taking it easy, man. By what means does dudism attempt to do this? Abiding. So there's some like churchy terminology going on there, right?
Yeah.
But he wants this religion to be taken serious. He was like a graphic designer.
Does it
designer.
Make any truth claims?
I didn't get that far, but I just thought it was quite interesting in the sense, I'll read you one other thing. He was a former graphic design artist. He says, I had been a student of religion and spirituality for years, but ultimately gave up on my quest. It seems that all schools of thought I encountered either took everything too seriously or were too irrational. So where does Christianity fit into those two things, right? Mm-hmm. But he's creating this close to 500,000 followers already. I mean, people are digging
this one
this
question
Judaism.
That I often will ask people when they want to suggest the idea that all religions are true is often asking that question. Well, what if you just make up a religion such as Judaism?
Yeah.
Does it suddenly become true? Right. And so that's why I was asking you, does he make any truth claims? Because thus far, all it sounds like is
there is a 12-step program that he's made up to like go in the following of Judaism. So I didn't look closely into that, but I'm sure, you know, he lays it out his, you know, religious stance.
The sort of the metaphysician in me says this religion seems rather anemic.
Well, right? it makes me wonder, can you even call it a religion?
Right.
It sounds like a way of life.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Christianity is a way of life, but it's more than that, right? It is a take on ultimate reality. This is the
way
reality.
It's making a truth claim. Right. I think a truth claim is different than a way of life. The way somebody likes to relax. So, I don't know that they're making a truth claim.
Right. That's why I'm thinking, well, right there, he says, you know, well, some religions take things way too seriously. And I'm thinking to myself, we shouldn't?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going that was going through my mind.
Yeah.
Well, and this is, I brought this up actually recently at a meeting that I was at, where there was this girl and she was talking about how some people take themselves too seriously. What they believe to be true, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I mean, how can you not? You know, you only have beliefs that you believe are true. If you didn't, you know, you wouldn't believe those things. You don't believe anything that you think is false. Mm-hmm. Everything you believe is true. And so you're going to live as though that's true and as you should, mm-hmm. as a sane person would do.
Anyway, there is only one movie that I watched with my dad in a movie theater. And I was 14 at the time. Terminator 2 had just come out. You know the story behind Terminator, right? So there's Skynet, and Skynet basically gains artificial intelligence and it turns on human beings. And that is the going dystopian view of AIs going haywire.
They're never like wonderful, you know, robots that stay good. They always go bad.
Yeah, even like iRobot with Will Smith, right? It's all about the robots going, again, haywire and turning on human beings. And so these kinds of movies raise the question, right? Okay, well, AIs, artificial intelligence, they're all well and good, but can we teach them right from wrong? Can they tell the difference between good and evil?
One of the things that's really fascinated me as of late is in the past when we would talk about things such as Terminator and whatnot, can we teach, you know, AI ethics? That was science fiction talk. That's changed.
Right.
Now when I address an audience about these things, I can tell that my interaction with the audience has changed. This is no longer science fiction talk. This is reality. This is where we actually are as a society. And to maybe give this a little bit of context, in the beginning of the 21st century, the Congress instructed the U.S. military to begin designing autonomous vehicles. And they even gave them a deadline. They said, listen, we want you to be able to create these autonomous vehicles by 2015. And so the military quickly began working on this, specifically the agency of DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. And as they began working on this, they got nowhere quickly and realized that they were going to need to get creative if they were going to actually meet this challenge or at least make any progress whatsoever. And so what they ended up beginning to do was set out a contest. And this contest was to create, you know, unmanned vehicles and to have a contest navigating obstacle courses to see, you know, who would win. And it's interesting, by the way, if you're interested more in this, you can read a great book on it called Machines of Loving Grace that talk about AI and the development of AI. And in doing it, they began to realize that it was actually easier to have a machine fly to the moon than it is to create a machine that can navigate rush hour traffic. That it's incredibly complicated, and that there are many different, not just programming challenges with regards to getting a car just simply to race that track, but then as they got into it more, if we are ever to bring this into the military and then particularly into civilian life, how are we going to do that in such a way that it can make ethical decisions? And one of the main ethical dilemmas that they're currently wrestling with is, and this is written in the book Machines Loving Grace, he says, the new ethical dilemma is, will humans allow their weapons to pull the trigger on their own without human oversight? Now, this might seem strange, but Lockheed and Martin are due. Now, if they'll meet this deadline, we'll see. They're due to hand over to the U.S. military in 2018 a long-range anti-missile called LRASM that is not only able, obviously, to shoot down enemy combatants at a long range, but it's able to do so autonomously. It is able to make autonomous decisions on its flight path, and more than that, its targeting decisions.
Right.
2018.
You know, that's really disturbing emotionally for us, right? I mean, it's one thing for human combatants to kill another human combatant, but robots killing humans?
It's not science fiction. Like, no. You can actually go on YouTube and I don't know why they do this. It's propaganda of sorts. Is Lockheed Martin actually has a YouTube video explaining exactly how this technology works, what it's meant to do, at least, not how they...
There was another movie back in 1968, 2001, Space Odyssey. Have you guys seen that?
I haven't seen it, no, but I...
Were you like a teenager when you saw that for the first time, Terry?
Oh, there it is. There it is.
Terry remembers when his dad took him.
No, I wasn't even born then, if you can imagine that. But it's about a space computer that takes this group to Mars, but in the process, he becomes quite human. And takes over the
ship. What's
that
machine's name again?
Hal.
Yeah, it's just the machine's name creeps me out.
I know. And his voice, I can still hear it in my head, how he interacts and what he's asking and how he's kind of manipulating the situation. So, I mean, as we move forward in all this AI, I mean, the question is, how human are they going to become, right?
Yeah. And what does it mean for them to become more human like that, too, is another question.
So
right?
What's the process of that?
Right, because... A key aspect of being human, I would argue, is morality and ethics. Are machines able to become moral agents?
Yeah.
Now, it's what's interesting about that, though, is there was recently an article that came out in The Economist. It was like a special edition. And the headline was Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. In this article, Simon Parkin, who's a British writer and journalist, he ended his article by writing this. He says, in science fiction, the moment at which a robot gains sentience is typically the moment at which we believe we have ethical obligations toward our creation. So it's interesting for many people, and I would agree, that they don't care whether or not the machine understands ethics in the same way an animal doesn't understand ethics. But if the machine understands pain, well, then that's when you have moral obligations. He goes on to say, an iPhone or a laptop may be inscrutably complex compared with a hammer or a spade, but each object belongs to the same category, tools. And yet as robots begin to gain the semblance of emotions, as they begin to behave, this is critical, as they begin to behave like human beings and learn to adapt our cultural and social values, perhaps the old stories need revision. He ends with this. At the very least, we have a moral obligation to figure out what to teach our machines about the best way in which to live in the world. Once we've done that, we may well feel compelled to consider how we treat them.
So how they become or achieve sentience is through us. Right?
That's the thing. And how do they do that? By mimicking a human being.
And stories, as you know, one of the articles was talking about, right?
Right.
We're inputting as humans, fallible. Yeah. Keep putting this information into this being or computer, and the outcome is going to be somewhat of what we've inputted into it.
That raises a number of issues. One is, well, there are, in that article that Andy was just reading from, they talk about a number of different organizations that are actually working on this, right? Teaching robots right from wrong ethics and things like that. And they take different approaches. And one of them is to treat them like children and reading them stories upon stories upon stories. I think that's what you were referring
to. Basically filling them full of information.
Right. So going from simple to more complex issues, that sort of thing. I thought it was really interesting that they're trying to treat them like blank slates and little children. And because my intuition immediately is, well, if we are trying to create little humans out of this, well, are we blank slates?
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah,
you know, Kant would argue we aren't blank slates, that we're born into the world with brains that are wired to understand the world in certain ways, that we process information from birth, from the beginning, in certain ways as we interpret, our brain interprets our five senses, and then that is, you know, made aware to our mind. So in that sense alone, no, we're not a blank slate. However, I what I see, though, with them doing is with this, what's often called machine learning, is that that we've learned that you can't systematically teach a human being or a machine how to do certain things. Now, this is often referred to as tacit knowledge in the area of epistemology. And by tacit, it's simply the word silence. So this is silent knowledge. This is knowledge that you really just can't teach systematically. And so that's why they're treating these machines like a child.
It's sometimes called skill knowledge.
Yeah.
Right? It's like riding a bicycle. Right? You don't consciously think of all your muscle movements when you're riding a bicycle. It's just something that you learn, and you do it without even really thinking about everything that you're doing.
And one of the prime examples of tacit knowledge is actually driving a car. Mm. Now, I'm sure we've explained this before, but for new listeners, I'll give you this illustration again. Consider that there's three main forms of knowledge, and there's facts, experience, and then this what I've just called tacit knowledge or a skill knowledge, as Steve said. If you think about it, when you drive a car, how does that work? Like, if you passed your driver's test, well, does that mean you know how to drive a car? And clearly, you know, anybody who's had siblings, you know, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. You know, passing a test does not mean you know how to drive a car. So that's facts, right? You know the facts, but the facts don't necessarily mean you know how to drive the car. But then you could ask, well, what about experience? And the truth is that, you know, you've been experiencing driving a car since you, you know, were a baby. Here you are 16, 17, 18, whatever years later. And you could ask the question, well, do you know how to drive a car then? You know, just because you've experienced it, you sat in the passenger seat. And of course, we'd say, well, no, that's not good enough to know how to drive a vehicle. You know, and we could give lots of examples of how we know that's not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, of course, you can apply all this to riding a bike as well as
riding a bike about. Or playing a musical instrument, you know, all that sort of thing. It applies.
So then the question begins, well, then how do you learn how to drive a car? And the only way that you learn how to drive a car is, yes, you need to take those facts. Yes, you got to take that experience and you need to put them into the actual doing of it. Mm-hmm. So we would call this tacit skill knowledge. It's doing knowledge. You actually have to begin to do it. And now you're beginning to process all of that information that we can't systematize. And this is really what machine learning developed with IBM through learning to teach a machine how to beat a human being at Jeopardy, back with Watson, if you remember, is they realized, how are we going to do this? It's a very difficult thing to do. And they began to realize, well, if we feed it tons of information and we learn and we help this machine make these web of connections, and then we help it to know when it's done a good job of making these, you know, web of connections, and when it's done a poor job of it, it can begin to learn how to do it better. This is what machine learning is, to, you know, the best that I'm not like a AI specialist or anything by any stretch, but that's how I understand it. And from the epistemological challenge, that's what's taking place.
As I read through that article from The Economist, one thing that just kept coming to my mind is everybody is assuming that ethics is all about behavior. This is a Turing test, right? If something starts behaving, like whatever circumstance it is in, and it behaves in a certain way, that doesn't necessarily mean that this robot actually knows what is right from wrong. It's just input-output at that point.
It was funny you say that, Steve, because that's exactly what went through my mind as I've read more on this subject and when I was reading The Economist. A lot of people are making this leap. They don't understand. There's a difference between teaching a computer to understand ethical decision-making and teaching a computer to know what those ethics actually are. To actually know right from wrong is different from doing right and wrong.
And I think what you mean by that is, if I were to clarify it a little bit more, there's a difference between teaching a robot to make a behavioral decision as opposed to teaching the robot to actually know what these are.
Right. This, by the way, was teased out when I was reading that, with regards to, we have to, as human beings, we have to teach the computer what the ethic is. The computer doesn't know the ethic. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the distinctives of a human being, is that human beings have an innate sense of value and dignity. We have an innate sense of ethical decision-making that we come into the world with. The machine doesn't have that, so that we need to help that machine to understand the ethics, to understand the values.
It's all based on what we're inputting, correct? Mm-hmm. So the consequences that could happen from our input, just say, I came across an example of them saying, you know, to a robot or a bot, you know, we need to eradicate cancer. So the bot or robot goes out and kills everybody that has cancer.
Yeah, what kind of ethic is actually being put in?
Right.
Is it utilitarian ethic? Is it, you know, virtue ethic?
Yeah.
What would that look like from a robot?
And that understanding is from our input into the machine.
To put it in the sense of where rubber meets the road, literally, with like a car, this is the challenge of teaching a vehicle. And by that, we mean, you know, AI, the AI that's operating that vehicle, teaching it how to navigate rush hour traffic and to make ethical decisions, so that if the car is put into a dilemma where it needs to either hit a brick wall or hit a human being, it's going to know what decision to make. And this gets interesting in that it needs to not only know the value of the outside world that it's interacting with, but it has to understand its own value. This, to me, I think is going to create some interesting challenges, right? So it needs to know what is the value in the car. It needs to know of what the value of the car is, and it needs to know what the value of those those things outside of the car are.
And how are those values determined is the question that immediately comes to my mind.
And that's not always easy to know, by the way.
Right.
I like, because we all know or would agree as Christians that human life is priceless, that it is an extreme value, and that one person is not more valuable than another person. However, if an autonomous vehicle is given the situation in which to hit a teenage girl or an old woman, well, which one should it choose?
I think that's the same challenge that utilitarianism runs into, right? This utilitarian ethic that says, you know, the greatest good for the greatest number of people. The problem with that is you can never tell, you can never figure out how a particular event is going to unfold or how a particular person's life is going to unfold. Because in that situation that you just described, that old woman may have created like this cure for cancer the next day, right?
Or maybe she has a huge extended family and the teenage girl is an orphan.
Right.
Well, now, if you kill the old woman, you're going to hurt lots of people that are going to mourn mm-hmm. her loss. And she created the cure for cancer. That's incredibly pragmatic, mm-hmm. right? Whereas this teenage girl, maybe no one would know that she passed.
Right. And then, you know, even taking one step farther from that, by killing this woman and the old woman and her relatives and everybody that she knows suffering, it somehow, you know, changes them and that they all turn into serial killers. You know, but then later, you know, 10 years down the road, they all repent of their serial killing and they start doing some amazing work to restore the world, you know, and solve climate change issues or whatever, right? I mean,
now the problem
with
this,
you just never know what's going to happen down the road and you can't possibly calculate all of that.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you, Steve. Well, don't you see one of the problems with this, though, is that this is assuming a level of knowledge that the machine is not going to have, nor mm-hmm. a human being. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, a human being driving a car is going to have to deal with similar right. dilemmas, right? Mm-hmm. Now, a machine is going to be able to process these things much quicker. However, the machine's also going to have more of a challenge to do so. For example, I was thinking about this one. Mm-hmm. How easy it could be if we had a society of self-driving and, you know, autonomous vehicles where people could wreak havoc on traffic by putting a plastic doll right. on the street. Now all of a sudden, the vehicle is going to see an object that looks like a baby. What does it do? You know, mm-hmm. a human being runs into a similar situation that we right. don't always make the right decision no. when a police officer encounters, say, a teenager with a plastic gun. And they're not sure which yeah. it is, right? One of the things that came out in the article, and I think that this is something people are just going to have to begin to understand, is that by autonomous vehicles, we can't aim for perfection. That at the end of the day, the machine is going to make a mistake as much as a human being is going to make a mistake. However, and I think this is really the big push in autonomous vehicles, is that the AI is going to make less mistakes than a human being will.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as Christians moving forward, are we on board with all this? This seems it will have good consequences and bad consequences along the way. There's going to be mistakes and good things that come out of it. So it's like,
personally, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I am too.
I would love to just sit in my car and read a book while it drives me to work. Like, that sounds fantastic to me. I like the idea in the same way I like planes that fly themselves, mm-hmm. you know, that in most planes do most of the flying, you know?
Yeah.
It was funny. We've talked with a pilot. We have actually a show that will come out later with a pilot. And he said, listen, you pay us basically for
sitting and having coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. But there is, like, you know, that 1 minute in a flight
yeah.
that's where we're making our money, you know, when certain decisions need to be made.
Like when Scully landed his plane in the New York River.
Right, right. Was that his name?
He made his money that day.
Yeah, he made his money. However, this is my challenge. I love the idea of artificial intelligence and what it could do for mankind. What I don't like, though, is a secular society that doesn't have a firm foundation of what a human being is mm-hmm. and is willing to give up our humanity to a machine that can mimic humanity. And that's where I've got a problem is yeah. in the idea of, and I have the same problem with regards to animals as well, mm-hmm. is giving them human value. It doesn't actually give them value. It removes our value.
Yeah, and that sort of thing we've touched on before when it comes to that brothel that was opened in Barcelona with sex mm-hmm. robots, or sex dolls rather, right? And now there's a group, for example, down in, I think it's called Harmony, down in California, where they're trying to fuse AI technology with sex dolls. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just imagine like what that means for women, for example, right? When men, well, I guess men and women both, you know, they could have their sex dolls, and what would that mean for humanity?
Benefits. If I understand what you're saying, Steve, yeah. is I think one of the things you're talking about is how is this technology impacting our own humanity?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly dehumanizing, right? That we are substituting, you know, like we're a real human woman should be. Now we're switching that out with a sex doll, which is purely for my gratification, and I think it makes us less human that way. A listener actually sent in a question that kind of connects with this. He says, this is a question for you, Andy. He says, I have a question for Andy. I know Andy did his doctorate on personhood. I was wondering...
doing my doctorate.
Right.
Okay. Continue on.
I was wondering, he says, what his thoughts were on how our need to be loved is foundational to our personhood, and what are the implications of a person receiving or not receiving love and affirmation from their parents, and how that affects a person's identity. So it's really a two-part question, how our need to be loved is foundational to our personhood.
Don't you guys agree that this is part of our brokenness, is that here we started creating artificial intelligence. We've created machines that mimic humans. I mean, that's what a robot is. It is a human mimicking machine, right? Mm-hmm. And we've turned that in on itself. And now we have, and we see this with people developing relationships. You know, people do this with all sorts of things. They develop relationships with objects. They develop relationships with animals.
And, or at least they think they are.
And that's a good point, right? They think they are. And what they'll do, what we call anthropomorphized language, right? They will use humanistic language and attribute it to that animal, or in AI's case, that object, that machine, and pretend that that is a person, right? And this is a real challenge to not only to in our understanding of that object, but our understanding of ourselves, in that it's very easy for us to become very self-deceptive. It's interesting to me. It reminds me of the myth of Narcissus. It's told in different ways in Greek mythology, but he looks into a pool, sees his reflection, falls in love with himself. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that's what I see in technology, is humanity seeing its reflection, falling in love with itself, and ultimately this kills Narcissus, right? And I see this killing our society as we become consumed with ourselves through our technology. Let me just say one other thing, though, that I think's important on this subject, and just to this listener, you know, thank you for writing that in. To be honest with you, I'm still processing that question. It's a question that I'm wrestling with and trying to understand. I don't know that I really have a grip on it yet, because there's different things that we know that we're trying to understand. For example, I'm trying to understand them scientifically, but I'm trying to understand them theologically, such as, have you guys ever heard of feral children?
Right. Yes.
Children that don't learn to speak by a certain age, and it's not very old. If they haven't heard human language, you know, and interact with it by, what is it, like age 4 or so, mm. you know, and we know that age 3 in there is like the golden time for learning language. They haven't learned it by then. From historical research that's been done, no one's ever successfully taught a child how to speak or know language after that point. I think that that's very interesting. And I'm trying to understand that, you know, why would God create a human being that way? That if a human being hasn't interacted with another human being and hasn't interacted with language by a certain time, it's gone. I'm not sure how to answer that question. I'm processing that.
Yeah. Would you say that personhood finds its entity, if you will, its existence only in community? Like, I mean, if you were all by yourself, would you still be a person?
I think you would be a person, but I think you would be less of a person. However,
or at least the person that is not kind of, if you will, functioning. I don't like that word in this case. Yeah. So a human, a person that is not functioning like a person should.
Agreed. However, one area of thought for me is that what we just talked about there works when we're talking about human relationships. But if we talk about your relationship with God, or God, particularly God's relationship to you, mm-hmm. I think is absolutely essential to our existence. If God is no longer in relationship with you, and you literally, as you were saying, Steve, have no relationship, you don't have relationship with God, you don't have relationship with people, I'm not sure that we could say that that is human, whatever that would be. The only relationship, I guess, that you would have would be relationship with yourself. This raises, by the way, really interesting implications theologically with regards to what heaven and hell is. In particular, I think we talked about this in a couple episodes ago with C.S. Lewis playing off these ideas with the Great Divorce and the idea in hell, a person begins to lose oneself as they become self-consumed, as they become more and more narcissistic.
So how would you define personhood? Would it involve rationality, consciousness? Well, what would be your definition of that?
Well, I would say that it's multiple things. I think to try to boil it down to one thing has become problematic. I don't know that we can just boil it down to one thing. We also know that with certain things, philosophically, theologically, it can be hard to necessarily give a precise definition more than we can point to examples of it. But one of the main things that I would argue with regards to what a person is something I've talked about before, that when you're dealing with a complex object, when you're dealing with a structure, a composite as I'd call it, it's defined by its purpose. That to me would be critical to understand what a human being is that a human being would be defined by its purpose. And theologically, as a Christian, we would say that a human being is that which has been created to be in relationship with God, in relationship with each other. And it's for this reason that I believe God created humanity in his image, and that we could actually fulfill that purpose, in that God is a relational God and he's endowed us with a relational image through him. And so to me, that would be the essence of what it would be to be a person. However, you can throw holes in, I can poke holes in that, such as if you were to look at a dead body, would that suddenly not be a human being? Well, no, I think that we would still say that that's a human being, but it gets back to what you were saying, Steve, is that person functioning? Maybe you see somebody in a coma, or if you see somebody sleeping and asking, is that a human being, right? Again, you're poking holes in that yeah. what I just talked yeah. about. But I would still say that that's a human being. This gets into ideas that I've been more and more thinking about with regards to, yeah, I think it's a human being, but you could ask, well, at what point would that no longer be a human being? At what point of deterioration as a dead body would it get to the place in which you would no longer even say that that's a human being any longer? As you can begin to see that those are difficult things to say. And ultimately, what I would argue is that what you have is you have a composite that is slowly reducing back to particulars. However, I'm not going to say that that's what it is. It just is particulars. I'm going to still say that as a human being, it's a composite that is created for a purpose.
Well, then I'd
have to really keep going to explain all that.
You're trying to draw some meaningful line in something that seems to come in a spectrum, right? Like the decomposition of a body
is a spectrum.
But where do you draw the line between, you know, personhood and non-personhood?
Because it's interesting when you have this composite that's going back to particulars, right? Mm-hmm. And at some point in that process, you're going to say, well, it's no longer the composite it once was.
And I think that's why I think we intuitively kind of recognize that in a sense, I think, and that's why we want to maybe treat dead bodies with respect, because mm-hmm. we're different from a lot of animals in that way. I wouldn't say that this doesn't happen in the animal kingdom at all. But we don't treat dead people just like
in the same way, even with living people, right? When from the womb outward, we would still say, well, that's a person, but it's still developing as a human. In the same way that you and I are a person, but we are still developing in our humanity. that we would ultimately say is fulfilled in death through life in Christ, mm-hmm. that we have a resurrected life in which we then would say, oh, we are fully human.
Okay. Then just the second part of the question quickly, what are the implications of a person receiving or not receiving love and affirmation from their parents and how that affects a person's identity? Now, I'm assuming that this person is not just talking about the consequences of not being loved and affirmed by parents. I mean, we see that all the time,
yeah.
Right? But how does that affect the person's identity? I guess in the metaphysical sense,
it seems to be directly tied to human flourishing. Now we can see that in how a person is affected by broken relationship. Say they grew up in a broken family, but we can see that even in more extreme cases from the 1950s where orphanages were tried to run like nurseries and often we see this where human beings are treated like a plant. If you water and feed them, they'll grow. And what they found with these orphanages is no, actually, if you don't have human interactions with another human, they will die. I think it's interesting, isn't it, that this is how we punish people? Even the most hardened criminal doesn't want to be put in isolation.
Mm-hmm. Solitary confinement.
Yeah, and not for very long they don't want to be there. And in fact, there's rules governing how long you can put a person, depending upon their age particularly, into solitary confinement till you do permanent damage to that individual. The point being, we were created and require relationship, or it will kill you from the inside out.
All right, let's wrap up there. Thank you for joining us. The Apologetics Canada podcast has been a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll see you next week with more stuff to think about. Ciao for now.